Yeah, it was funny. I've often thought about how even before I began to think about romantic love or being married, I had in my mind the idea that I wanted to be a father and a husband.
Some people just know they want to have kids, even when they're kids themselves. The writer Esau Macaulay is one of those people. He says the urge to be a dad at 6 or 7 years old had to do with wanting to feel and know the presence of his father.
I was raised by a single mother. She solo parented the four of us. And I knew that I felt the absence of my father from an early age. And I knew what it was doing to me as a child. And I thought, I wonder what would happen to a boy. And, you know, I don't thought about it as a boy because I was a little boy. What would it be like if a boy had a father who loved him from the moment that he was born all the way through? And how would that change how that child saw the world? And I said, I think that kid would be happier than I am now. And so I said, I want to be able to make some boy happy.
Esau now has 4 children, 2 boys, 2 girls, ranging in age from 5 to 13, and is working to make them all pretty happy. But he's contending with what he calls a dual experience, raising his kids in a comfortable home near Chicago, while at the same time calling up his own vastly different upbringing in Alabama. As adults, we inevitably bring experiences from our childhoods to the work of raising our own kids and to our relationships with them. Whether these were positive or negative experiences, they show up in our parenting. This idea will come up in our episodes many times over. It's just part of being human. But at times, it can feel like you're having to confront the differences between your kid's childhood and your own on a daily basis. Maybe you're having to recognize that your children's lives, that you are helping to build for them, can be hard to understand and even feel a part of. So, how do you parent in that context? This is the question Esau is asking.
I look at them and like they're in a different world. I don't know how to describe it other than I don't know what this is. And I don't know what comes next. And part of me feels like I hope that I'm not ruining this.
From 10% Happier, this is Childproof. I'm Yasmin Khan. Today, we're going to talk with Esau Macaulay about this tension, about how to be in your children's world when you feel outside of it. Our conversation after the break.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great-tasting, high-quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
Welcome back. Today we're talking with Esau Macaulay about how our own childhood experiences help shape who we are as people and as parents, and about raising kids when their childhood is so different from your own.
If one of the goals that I had was to make a better life for my family than the one that I had, then I would say I succeeded. But it's complicated because I succeeded precisely because of the pressures and the things that my neighborhood made me.
Esau is a professor of New Testament at Wheaton College in Illinois. He's also a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, where he writes commentary on social issues and on being a parent, a Black father to 4 children. I reached out to him after reading one of his recent essays in the Times. It was a piece that brought the reader into this inner experience, his grappling with the idea of raising his children middle class and in a 2-parent household, one where both parents were established professionals. In that essay, he describes how he grew up poor in Huntsville, Alabama, raised by a single mom. So he's had to confront how different his world is now and how to be a father in it. I should say, this is not a story about upward mobility or how a class change made something better. It's about this conflict that creeps up for a father when interacting with his children, about how to process a flood of memories in the moment. To understand this conflict, it's important to know where Esau's coming from.
You know, some people say they didn't know that they were poor. I knew that I was poor. Unless you grow up in poverty, it's really complicated to understand its nuances and its complexities. In other words, there's the sad parts that the people know about. You know, I lived in a context where there could be a potential for violence. And, you know, I know people who were shot and who were killed. But people, when they think about that, they get this idea that at every moment of your life, you're thinking about getting shot.
Yeah.
That's actually not the case. So like 95% of the time, I didn't feel unsafe because I knew how to navigate my community. You're just constantly aware. But the other thing that people don't see is the joy. I don't think that growing up with a lack of resources stamps out the ability to have joy. And so like that complexity of like finding these strange places for joy in the midst of a complicated context. And it's like, it's not like in the movies, at least in my part of Huntsville, Alabama, it wasn't like drive-bys every night. It was just like, you know, a couple times a year. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily in my neighborhood, two neighborhoods over. So it was really a matter of you learned how to navigate this community. So mm-hmm. you kind of come in and you'd go, you know what? There's the wrong crowd here at this place. The smart thing for me to do would be to leave. And if I stayed and something happened, I would be thinking as I left, I knew I shouldn't have been here. Or in my high school, it was one of the lowest performing schools in the state academically. We were always on some kind of academic probation. But if you took advanced classes, if you took, you know, advanced English or whatever, you could get a good education. So it was more along the lines of, instead of it just being there for you, you had to find your way through it. And that's the best way to talk about it, is that you couldn't passively survive in my neighborhood. You had to have a sense of, I want to be something, therefore I'm going to make these decisions. But if you made those decisions and things kind of broke your way, you still are at the mercy of kind of happenstance. You could do everything right and still find yourself in a bad situation.
Yeah, sure. What was your relationship like with your mother? Was she someone who helped you develop those skills?
Yeah, I think my mom, I tell people, she had a harder parenting job, but she had a very strong canvas within which to work with. So she would tell us stuff, but she had the neighborhood as a teaching point. In other words, my mom would say something like, if you don't do your schoolwork, if you don't do these things, this is your future. And so she couldn't teach me how to navigate the community because she didn't understand it like I understood it. But she could make it clear that that's what I needed to do.
How would she do that? Do you remember?
So we lived on the northwest side of Huntsville. The other side of Huntsville, there was this school that was one of the top performing schools in the country, and it was largely white. So it was one of those blue ribbon white schools all the way across town. Mm-hmm. People there had all the resources. We were the under-resourced school that was stereotypically, you know, nothing but thugs and criminals. Mm-hmm. My mom would say, she would say, those white people over there say you can't do it. Are they right? And she would say, like, they say that you're stupid. They say that you can't get an education. They say that Johnson High School students are less than the students at Grissom High School. And so it was really a contest of wills. But the other thing that was going on at the time is, coming from Huntsville, you're like an hour, hour and a half from Birmingham. You're near Montgomery. And so growing up, my heroes were people like Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, Fannie Lou Hamer. And so I knew about these Christian leaders who had fought against injustice. I think the best way to think about it is, there are all of these different forces telling you what you ought to be. There are all of these people offering you a life. And as a child, I'm trying to think through, well, which life do I want to actually pursue? And the neighborhood had one life, and my mother had another life.
In mind for you.
In mind for me. In mind for me. And I would say she won the argument.
As a child, though, that's a lot to take on.
Yeah. I don't know if I had a childhood in that sense. Like, you don't get the freedom to just be a kid. Now, I was still childish, and I still made mistakes, and I still frustrated my mother. But when I was in the first grade, it was the first time someone called me the N-word. I was sick, and I was trying to call my mom's job to get her to come get me, but I dialed the wrong number. I didn't even have like an adult voice. And it was a white guy on the phone. You could tell. And he says, you know, you stupid N-word, you don't know how to dial the number. This is the wrong number. And so I was 6 years old when I heard that. And so there was no sense in which I was ever innocent.
And as Esau said from the beginning, his father's absence always loomed. And a lot of how he parents now comes from what he remembers needing from a father himself. When he was older, Esau did form more of a relationship with his dad, and at one point confronted his father about not being around.
And I said to him, like, why didn't you come to any of my sporting events and stuff? And he was like, I was afraid of messing you up, and you seem to be doing well. Oh. I think that I lived long enough to see things from his perspective. When you're a child, you can only see things from a child's perspective.
Sure.
But as an adult, I just don't know if he knew how to parent, because he didn't know his father and he didn't know what to do. And so I think he just kind of, I think he panicked.
What would you say that you came away with then from your childhood experience in terms of what it meant to be a parent?
I think that the thing that I learned is loving your children is important. And being present for your children is important. So no matter what I'm doing, if my son or my daughters have a sporting event or a play or something, I'm there. My daughter just had a 2.5 hour, she's 5 years old. Uh-huh. It was a 2.5 hour Nutcracker performance.
Wow.
And she was on the stage for maybe 90 seconds.
Yeah.
Because it's like every kid anywhere in the city there's just at this Nutcracker performance. And the first time she was on stage, she literally just stood there. And I think she jumped twice. That was like the full extent of her ballet.
But you saw it.
She's like, did you see what I did? And even every day, now when she gets dressed or she gets her hair done, she comes to me. She just shows it to me. And she's waiting for me to say, I love it. It's beautiful. Or my son comes home when he drew something at school and he just waiting with this sense of expectation. Like, what is my dad going to say? And it doesn't matter if he just scribbled a circle. I said, this is the best circle I've ever seen. And I could see his face light up.
That's the thing about being a parent or a grandparent or a babysitter who's really close with a child. These very small, everyday acts of engagement have weight. They're the architecture of a relationship, of security. When Esau describes these moments, they sound like they unfold with ease. But he's now confronting some unexpected, complicated feelings about his children's more carefree life and his part in it.
So my children generally believe, and this is the hardest part because I just don't understand it, they feel safe all of the time. My children live, they get walked to school every day by their parents. They have a mom and a dad in the home. Both of us have terminal degrees. You know, they have 2 PhDs in the house. Mm-hmm. She actually got her bachelor's after we went away to college.
Oh, that's awesome.
She's an amazing woman. But when I was growing up, she had only a high school degree. She had a brain tumor when I was a kid. So we were on disability because she legitimately couldn't work. And we have like a doctor's and a professor's income. So it's just like totally different. Like, this is not like magical, but they have food to eat. On Christmas, anything they ask, you know, within, you know, reason, they ask for something for Christmas, there's a good chance they might get it. Uh-huh. I mean, no community is completely safe, but there's not like a real fear. There's never been a fight in any of their schools. You know, so it's just like they feel safe. They walk around the world assuming that the world is friendly and not hostile to them. And I don't want to make it seem like my children don't have problems. Everyone has problems. But I think that their life, in the sense of the angst, is relatively uncomplicated or less complicated. And so that's probably the biggest difference.
Well, how do you feel about that? Are you pleased with that?
I mean, that's what I wanted. And so in some sense, you feel like you won the game. If one of the goals that I had was to make a better life for my family than the one that I had, then I would say I succeeded. But it's complicated because I succeeded precisely because of the pressures and the things that my neighborhood made me. And so the sense of determination, the sense of grit, the ability to navigate difficult circumstances, the ability to see a challenge as a test of who you are as a person. And I don't know if my children always perceive things in that way. And so I wonder, like, I thought about what would happen if my children didn't have the same negatives that I had when I was a kid, but I didn't think about the ways in which those negatives would shape me. And so part of me wonders, well, then how will my children deal with really difficult circumstances? So, like, I was 5 or 6 years old the first time I had my first racial incident. Yeah. And my son is 13 and he hasn't had one yet. I don't think he's going to make it through his whole life like that. And so what would it be like to be 18 years old and finally find out some of the things that I knew as a child?
Well, do you talk to your son about it?
Yeah, I mean, my son exists in the world. But it's interesting how these things parallel. So I forget how old I was when I first heard about Rodney King. But Rodney King didn't surprise me as a kid. It was like, oh, that's how the world is. I knew it. When my son heard about George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery, he was more like, how could someone do this? And so we have these conversations about these things. I tell him, you know, you're 13 now. His voice has changed. He's gone from being like a cute 11, 12-year-old to a 13-year-old with a deep voice. And I say, well, son, now you're 13 and you have a mustache. So in the eyes of the law, they might think of you as a man or as a danger. And so you got to be really careful about how you interact with police officers. Like, we have those conversations. But because he hasn't seen it up close, I don't know if the lessons I tried to teach him are like in him the way that they were in me.
Right. It's more theoretical.
It's more theoretical. And so I'm worried that his positive sense of self will one day get him into trouble, if that makes any sense.
Coming up, where Esau sometimes feels like he can't avoid his past in moments of parenting, he's also discovered the times when he feels the most free as a father. More of our conversation after the break.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome back. We've been talking with the writer Esau McCauley about confronting the differences between your kids' experiences growing up and your own. You write about this contrast of your own childhood and your children's in a recent New York Times essay, and you said that you don't understand their world.
Yeah.
And one of the lines that stuck out was something like, you watch them sleep sometimes to see what it looks like to have dreams that are free of nightmares.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I do think watching your children sleep is like this other portal where you can just sit and have all these reflections about yourself or them or anything. But I'm imagining you standing at their bedroom door or sitting on the side of their bed. And what does come to mind when you watch them?
Well, my daughter, she gets a hug and a kiss before she goes to bed, but she wants me to give her a kiss while she sleeps. This is very important to her. And so she wakes up every morning and goes, "Did you kiss me last night while I was asleep?" And like, she goes up to her room and she goes to bed and she goes to sleep expecting the next day to be as good as the day that preceded it. And so you can just kind of tell that they're like untroubled. And maybe I was untroubled as my mom looked at me, but I remember how I felt as a kid. I remember like the actual prayers that I prayed at night.
What were they?
I wanted to be able to make a different life for my mom and my siblings. And I was small, but I was the second oldest. So I was the oldest man in the house, but I wasn't a man, I was a kid. So I couldn't protect the people that I cared about. And I would do something as simple as like, "God, please let me grow faster so that I can take care of my mom and my sisters and my little brother. Boy, then we would live somewhere else that was nicer." I used to have this dream that I could like pay for my mom to get a house. That was something I always thought was cool.
Yeah.
But I could pay for my mom to own her own home. I remember thinking those things as a kid. And I don't think that my kids think those things. And so I am sitting at the door looking at another world. Like, I don't know what it's like for them to like just go to sleep and to have, I mean, they have anxieties. I don't want to make it seem like my kids live a carefree life. Being a human being is hard. They get nervous about friendships and all of the small things that come as a part of being a child. Mm-hmm. They experience those things. But what they experience is common to childhood, not the added things. And so I look at them and like they're in a different world. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to describe it other than I don't know what this is. And I don't know what comes next. And part of me feels like, I hope that I'm not ruining this. Like, I gave them all of these things, but now it's my job to help steward these things well.
How did these feelings start to creep to the surface for you? Was it always there from the moment you became a dad, or has it evolved?
I would say that for long periods of time, my wife, she was in the military, so you move every 2 to 3 years, mm-hmm. and we're often staying on base housing. So on-base housing, if you're living abroad, it's not bad, but it's kind of like normal houses. And everybody there is basically in the same situation. And that is so unique.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't until now that we're actually back in the United States. We are living in the community we expect to be in for a while. And we kind of bought a home we expect to raise our kids.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to say that even though we've been married for a long time between military and education, we've never lived in a community for more than 3 years. And we've never bought a house that we didn't intend to sell within 2 to 3 years. And so this is the first time we felt like, oh, we're here. Like, I've arrived at this place that I've been trying to get to my entire life.
After years of moving around, the family is settled in a house that they're going to be in for a while. It feels great to have the space and stability, but there's something about it that's also disorienting. That's what Esau's standing in the middle of now. You know, the world that your children live in now is your world now too. And I'm wondering, do you just as an individual, as a professor, as an adult, do you feel comfortable in the world that you live in now?
Oh, I don't fit in here at all. That's one of the interesting things about all of it. It's not that I don't understand my children's world. I don't understand the world that I live in. So I have some friends who grew up like I did. There's 2 or 3 other friends of mine who are Black and who grew up, you know, poor and who are now part of the middle class. And we often talk about these things. We talk on the phone and we text. And so we just have these conversations. And the thing is, if I talk about my past to someone who wasn't there, they can't emotionally handle it. They treat me like I'm like some victim. Mm-hmm. And so they get, "Oh, you were shot at. Tell me about it." And I was like, "Well, I was shot at, but that's not the whole of the community, you know?" And so I think I feel often alienated. One of the reasons I talk about the past a lot in my own writings is because I want people to know that that community is worthy of analysis. It's worthy of our stories being told. It's worthy of it. And not in just some kind of exhibitionist way,
right,
but that there's beauty there. And so when I write about my community, I want people to feel it. I didn't find myself or my voice as a writer until I talked about the community that I knew. And the other thing that's really weird about it is they don't allow you to speak about it until you leave it. In some sense, like, I had to go get a master's degree and a PhD and become a writer so that I could talk about that community with the credentials that society needs me to have. But to get those credentials changes you in a certain way. And so I write about that community with a sense of space and a sense of slight alienation, because even if I represent them well, there's a sense in which I am not them. And so I'm in this strange place where I live here and I work here, but I'm not always comfortable here. I'm not always comfortable in, like, the neighborhoods that raised me, because I'm not that person either. I'm kind of stuck in this in-between space.
His friends on the text thread may get it, but he can't take his children back to his childhood to understand. Esau does take them to Huntsville, though, to visit family. But they don't see everything, at least not how he sees it. Because they're just kids, and they're just visitors.
And they're in the community, and I think they recognize the poverty, but they don't feel it. And so I think one of the hardest things is holidays in poor communities are feasting. Mm. Like, when you go back for Christmas and Thanksgiving, there's tons of food. I mean, it's the best food that they have all year because everyone brings in all of their stuff. And when you're really small, you know, you're talking about, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. You don't care if you're just stacked on top of each other. You're like, oh, can we all just sleep in the living room, all of the cousins? And so they don't see it because they don't recognize, okay, the only thing in the house is Thanksgiving food. And in the refrigerator, there's nothing but, like, some cheese, some eggs. They don't understand that, like, after this food goes away, what is in the refrigerator is what's actually normally there. And, you know, everyone dresses up for holidays. And so you come in, everyone has on their best outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And so they see it, but they don't see it. The other thing is, my neighborhood isn't, like, dilapidated. Huntsville, where we're from, was once a working class neighborhood that kind of dropped down. So there's individual houses and there's yards. So if you just drive through it during the day, you don't know it. And so there's all kinds of ways in which you have to live there to understand what it's about.
So you are describing, obviously, very clearly how you have this experience of having just very clear memories of your own childhood. And you've obviously taken your experience of growing up in Huntsville and you've brought it with you to adulthood, like we all do with our pasts. So how have you figured out how to parent in your children's world now? Can I quote you back to you?
Oh, you quote me. Yes, go ahead. What did I say?
In your essay, you wrote at one point, you say, "How do you parent when you were raised in a context of fear and your children are not afraid? It's an odd dilemma when you've worked your entire life to ensure that they will not be." And you go on to say, "I'm not sure. Ask me in a couple of decades." But I'm wondering if you've thought about it since you wrote it, if I could ask you now, how do you parent in that context?
I am not sure that I'm doing it right. Like, it sounds very straightforward, but I try to love. And I try to form their imagination. I try to say, okay, I want you to think about the kind of person that you want to be.
Mm.
So in a house where the accomplishments are pretty straightforward, in other words, all of my children are doing fine academically, I said, you know what? I don't care about your grades. Like, I really don't. What I care about is the kind of person you're becoming. We speak a lot about imagination and character. Mm-hmm. And, like, it sounds strange to say that a house is rooted in love, but it really is. Whenever our children get upset, the first thing I say to them is that you have no enemies in this home. Your mom loves you. Your dad loves you. I make them go through the list. Does your dad love you? Does your mom love you? Do your sister? Yes, they all love me. I say, well, then whatever you're upset about, whatever is happening to you, it isn't because of a lack of love. And so that means if we all love one another, then we can begin to work through our problems. And my faith is really important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I recognize that, like, my life is not just about me. My life is about serving the children. And I know I model for my children my own failure. So if I say something or do something to them that I shouldn't have done. And if I do it in front of the other kids, I call all of the kids back together and say, Dad said this or Dad did this. I shouldn't have done it. And if it's okay for me to say that, it's okay for you to say that. I used to try to parent perfectly and do everything right.
What does that even mean?
I don't know. Maybe the parents who never get tired, you never lose your temper, you come to everything, you have the right words, the wisdom, no matter what. And I think it's also, I'm very careful. I mean, this is just normal stuff. Like how I speak to their mother. I remember like listening to how my father spoke to my mom when I was a kid. I remember seeing how other men spoke to their partners or their girlfriend. And I remember how that affected me. So I also say, not only do they need to see love, they need to be loved, they need to see me treat their mom with respect and honor. I think that for me, it is really about, I wish I had, all I can say is, what can you do other than love the people who are dear to you and hope that you do as little damage as possible?
Do you grapple with this out loud with your wife, with the other dads on the text thread?
Yeah,
where do you get to have these conversations?
I talk to my wife all of the time. We often you huddle. I don't know if other people do this. You parent, and then after you parent, you come back and go, how did that go? Was I too harsh? Or, you know, what should I have done? And so we coach each other up. Or she steps in. Everybody has these things that trigger you as a person.
Yeah.
And so there's certain things to like trigger my wife. And I see my wife getting upset about something. And I'll step in and go, I'll take care of this. Or she'll see me. Because my wife she's much more of an academic achievement person. Mm. And so if the kids aren't doing well academically, which is like a B for her or whatever, she gets all worked up. And I say, hold on. Like, I got it. Like, there's no elementary school transcripts, you know, it'll be fine. And it's the same thing with when I get upset about something, you know, I am like particular about certain things and she'll step in and go, Esau, you know, don't worry about it. So the article that I wrote, I asked the exact question that you asked me, how do you all parent your children, given the fact that they're raised so much differently than we are? I texted that question to some friends and we all said, we don't know. But we talk about it. We encourage one another because we know there's a stereotype about the Black father. And so we talk about those things. So it's an ongoing conversation with both my wife and I, and also with some of my friends.
What are the ways when you feel most connected to your kids in your life together? You're just in sync and it feels natural.
So there's these moments where I see their happiness. And I'm not talking about like from buying them like some, just like the stuff that you can do for free as a parent. Those were the things that like matter. For example, my son, my wife, once again, this is the thing she cares about, things that I don't care about. She's into limiting their electronics now much more. You know, she keeps it, you got to turn it off, whatever. But now my son, my youngest son, he had never played paper football. I don't know if you know how, you probably never done this too, but in elementary school, you get the paper and you kind of push.
You fold the pieces of paper and then you.
Yeah, and you flick it back and forth. My son, he just addicted to it. He said, I'm the Tom Brady of paper football the other day. And he's just happy. And so there's so many times during the course of an ordinary day where there is these eruptions of joy that the children have. And I get really, really moved by these things. Like, they're not emotional to them. They're just them being happy. But when I see them happy and I see that I'm participating in that happiness, that's the happiest I am as a person.
Huh. Is that an opportunity where it's you are not thinking about this dual experience that you've talked about of your childhood?
No, that's the problem. You can't escape it. Because when I see them happy, in my head, I'm contrasting it with the happiness that I didn't have. I'm writing a book about some of these same experiences. Mm-hmm. And I'm writing a chapter about my sons versus my daughters. And one of the reasons why my experience with my daughters is so different than my sons is because I distinctly remember what it was like to be a son who wanted a father. And so everything that I did with my sons has that dual memory.
Huh.
But with my daughters, it is actually freer because I'm not reliving them. So for example, when my daughter was young, I used to do her hair for her before it got too complicated. I can't do it now because she's 11 now. Daddy's trash at doing ponytails. And so she will tell me that. But when she was a kid, daddy did it and it was great. And so when I was doing her hair, there was no sense in which I'm reliving anything. So it was free.
Free, like you're liberated.
Yeah, I'm liberated. I'm not remembering anything. And so it's actually parenting my daughters is much easier emotionally, less complicated emotionally than my sons, because my sons, there's this dual experience. With my daughters, it is different. So like when my daughter comes in every single day and says, this is my outfit for the day. And I go, I love it. That's something that I never needed someone to tell me when I was a kid. And so it feels a lot different.
When did you have that realization that you were having these different modes?
I remember wondering like why. It was actually one of the things I had to learn how to do as a parent, because I had certain experiences with my sons and I was trying to like recreate the dynamic between me and my father with my sons.
Yeah.
But I wasn't trying to create that with my daughters. And I realized I was responding to them different emotionally. And then I understood why. So that's when it became real. I was like, why do I respond this way when my son does something in a different way when my daughter does something? And I've had to work on being as free with my sons as I am with my daughters.
Have you been able to do that?
That's where I've been growing as a parent, is to try to be as, I have. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is by allowing space to be who they are and not be little me's. But it's really hard to change my daughter into a little me. And so I've been working on that.
Esau actually has a forthcoming children's book based on a father's relationship with his daughter. It's called Josie Johnson's Hair and the Holy Spirit. He says it was easier to take on a creative project focused on that father-daughter relationship because it didn't have the same emotional complexities of his own childhood and thinking about fathers and sons. And then there's the relationship between a son and his mother. You are still close with your mother?
Yes.
I'm wondering what your interactions are like with her now that you're a father and that you do have this different world.
I think that my mom, and this is one of the things that's been tricky for me, because I think my mom is more excited about my accomplishments than I am. Mm. My mom is celebrating me, but what she's actually doing is celebrating that her sacrifice was worth it. In other words, my mom gave up a lot so that we could have even the childhood that we did. Mm-hmm. She put off going to college. She graduated after all of us had gone off to college. And so she went through all of this stuff to raise these four children by herself. And now when she sees me accomplish something, I think for her it shows I didn't waste my time. And so when she's proud of me, I can't say, oh, Mom, this doesn't matter. What I say instead is, I couldn't do this had it not been for you.
So when she sees her grandchildren having this untroubled life, it's very satisfying. Yes. To her. She doesn't have any inner conflict about that.
I say, you did this.
Yeah.
I would say that I'm trying to give my mom joy by being the kind of son that would make her proud. And in that sense, I guess she's still parent to me because she still exerts that influence over me. That's kind of where I am now, that I honor my mom by keeping the things that she placed deep within me and then passing that on to my kids in the healthiest way I know how.
Esau says you don't have to repeat your parents in order to honor your parents. Maybe that's part of his dual experience of processing memories from his time as a child while raising his own children. And maybe a person just has to coexist with that tension rather than try to resolve it, so that we don't feel like we are turning away from the things that made us who we are, even when we're moving forward with our kids. Thanks for listening to our conversation with Esau McCauley. And for an upcoming episode, we want to hear from you on what we think is a pretty universal issue for parents: sleep deprivation. How are you managing your lack of sleep and what's causing it? Maybe it's your children actually waking you up, but maybe it's concern over a teenager who's out late or worry about how to get things done. Perhaps your kids are adults and on their own, but you'll just never be a sound sleeper again. We want your tired selves to tell us what's causing your lack of sleep and how it's affecting your life. You can email us or record a voice memo and send it to childproof@10%.com. That's TENPercent.com. Today's show was produced by Palace Shaw and Will Coley. Our managing producer is Kimmy Regler, and our executive producer is Jen Poyan. Scoring and mixing by Chester Guasta of Ultraviolet Audio. Carolyn Packer-Riggs wrote our theme music. Connor Donahue is our technical operations manager. Childproof is a production of 10% Happier. If you like what you're hearing, please take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It's a small way for you to help more people find the show. Thanks. If you like our show, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review. Episodes of Childproof are available free wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to hear new episodes 1 week early, you can download Amazon Music. Or if you want to hear new episodes early and ad-free, you can subscribe to Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app. Please support our show by filling out a survey at wondery.com/survey.